Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Eric Schmidt, Yaron Werber, and Luba Greenwood, with special guest Adam Feuerstein. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So while 2024 started off strong, with the XBI passing 100 for the first time in 2 years in February, that rally has reversed, and the biotech index is now flat year over year. In April alone, the XBI fell 11%. And if you look at the charts, biotech has traded in lockstep with interest rates. There's some new hope for cuts this year, which is bullish, but the sector continues to underperform the broader markets. According to Leerink, one thing that's different compared to this time last year is that equity issuance from public biotechs has been very strong. Follow-ons and PIPEs are at record highs, more than 3x year over year at $19.5 billion, and IPOs and private financings are up as well compared to last year. In Q1, $1.3 billion was raised in IPOs, which is more than three times the $375 million in the first quarter of 2023. However, a typical strong year has 50 IPOs, and we've only had 10 IPOs well into 2024. Small and mid-cap M&A activity is flat year over year. One interesting thing that Stiefel noted is that there's been a shift from commercial to mid-stage M&A. And in terms of dollars spent, more than half of M&A involved phase two companies or programs. So we're going to talk about there was an acquisition this week, the $2.4 billion acquisition, which Luba is going to take us through. But before we do that, I'll just open it up to the group in case anybody else wants to comment on industry sentiment and what's been going on in general.
Well, maybe I'll take a quick stab at Yaron. So we just published our sentimometer, which, you know, it's something that we've been doing for several years now. And it's usually a great lagging indicator, frankly. I know Adam looked at it many times, and he has a great pulse, too, in his work, and obviously Eric and Luba as well. And where we is, it really suggests that sentiment, once again, is sort of bottoming out. You wouldn't be surprised. Usually it sort of tracks what the sector does. When things are good, everybody's bullish. So you look for major extremes and sort of inflection points. And people are, on the small cap side, they really feel stocks are undervalued and they were pretty constructive and they've turned a little bit more negative now or concerned just given what's been going on with the space. And in large cap, they've been sort of guardedly sort of unenthusiastic. But when you look at it to us, it feels like things are turning the corner again, just given sentiment so bad. And that's usually a good sign.
You know, I'll just add on that sentiment is sort of, as Yaron said, all over the map sometimes with regard to, you know, how stocks performed over the last 2 or 3 weeks. The good news from where I sit, at least, is that the folks out there on the buy side are engaged, not necessarily the generalists, but certainly the specialists. And I think they view this type of an environment is one where they can make money, one where we are seeing a good dispersion of stock prices, stocks with good news being rewarded for that news, stocks with bad news, obviously not. So for the most part, I think this environment is a great stock picker's market. Most investors want nothing more, nothing less. And as a result, you know, we're all pretty busy these days. I'm sure that Yaron will vouch for that.
Yeah, I would say to echo what Yaron and Eric said, it's Adam. You know, it's interesting, even though, you know, the numbers look bad, I guess just my informal chatting with investors, no one seems to be particularly pained or depressed. You know, I think people, maybe it's just because of we've had this protracted downturn and we've gone through this before in these kind of cycles, these up and down cycles that people are kind of used to it. And but I guess I agree with Eric. You know, I do feel like people are really engaged and are data. I don't hear a lot of distress in the voices of the people that I speak to right now.
Yeah, so maybe let me just provide another, because I totally agree, and that's why when we look at this data, to us it's a real positive indicator, because things haven't been great, but people are not depressed. People are very engaged and they're looking for new ideas, and that's usually the sentiment's about to shift back to the positive, and that's kind of maybe what we're looking for.
Luba, any thoughts generally on the market? And also, can you tell us more about the Ono Decifera deal?
Yeah, absolutely. And just want to echo what everybody has been saying. I'm also seeing generally people are very positive. Also speaking, in addition to that, just speaking with some of our service providers and lawyers and others, they're very busy. I think that we are going to see even more deals, IPOs that are coming up that we don't see yet that people are working on. So absolutely echo what everybody else is saying. Things are looking up and sentiment is much better. Of course, we'll cover today some of the more on the general side, what we've seen, the cancer moonshot. We'll cover that. There are some definitely headwinds and pressures against the industry still, and also challenges with pharma going after U.S. government for IRA. So there are definitely challenges, but even with all of that, it's impressive that the industry is still doing really well. And happy to, cover the exciting news. I mean, this is another example. It's not the largest acquisition to date, but it is quite large. Ono, which is a Japanese company, has just announced acquiring of Decifera for $2.4 billion. And, you know, it's an interesting move strategically. It's certainly number one is a move to beef up Ono's pipeline. As we know, they have the cancer drug PD-1 inhibitor Opdivo, which generated billions of dollars. But their patents for that drug are about to expire in 2028. And because of that, also sales are decreasing very rapidly. So they need to offset this decline with sales of the Decifera drugs that they just acquired. So Ono is lagging in sales in Europe and US. So this acquisition will help them generate revenues in those key regions, but not just generate revenues, but actually develop real sales capabilities in the US and Europe. As you may recall, Ono outsourced the US sales of Opdivo to BMS. They did co-develop the drug together. Just to give you a sense, BMS generated just even in 2022 about $6.3 billion. Ono from royalties got only about $500 million. So they are recognizing the importance of that U.S. and European market. Ono will use Decifera's sales network in the U.S. They'll actually expand the hub that the company now has on the East Coast, and they'll set up an additional hub in Europe. Decifera is a kinase inhibitor expert, which is going to be a big plus for Ono. They also have a very strong oncology pipeline. They do have one cancer drug, as I mentioned, that is currently on the market. It's has been FDA approved for GIST, which is gastrointestinal stromal tumor drug. It's called Qinlock. It for now it generates about 160 or so million. But the sales are expected to increase to about $400 or $500 million. It's a fourth line treatment for GIST. They have another drug in final clinical stages also that's set to be approved in second half of the year. So very strong pipeline, which is going to be a big plus for Ono. And again, it is, as I mentioned, not the biggest deal. I would say second biggest deal, but it does offer an opportunity for Ono to fill out its pipeline, broaden its global coverage. It also, as you may recall, in February struck a $227 million buy-box deal in February for autoimmune inflammatory disease. So it's a big win for the industry. Good to see deals like this and for Ono and their expansion.
Yeah. Thanks, Luba. And in other deals this week, Novartis is acquiring Mariana Oncology, which is a preclinical stage company focused on developing radioligand therapies for solid tumors, for $1 billion upfront with an additional $750 million in milestones. Just 3 months ago, Mariana announced $175 million Series B financing, valuing the company at $313 million. So that's a pretty nice return for those investors in a very short period of time. Mariana Oncology is the first acquisition of a company coming out of RA Capital's incubator. So most people think about RA as a crossover and public investor, but they now also do venture creation. Mariana came out of the RA Tech Atlas work. And those of you who don't know about Tech Atlas, what RA does is they map out different modalities and indications, and they use that work to predict M&A interest, among other things. So that's kind of a cool thing. The radiopharmaceutical space has been, of course, really hot, and Novartis markets the leading radiopharmaceutical drug, Pluvicto, which had close to $1 billion in revenue in 2023, and also Lutathera, which brought in $600 million in 2023. Outside of Novartis, Lilly, AstraZeneca, and BMS have also spent collectively billions of dollars to acquire radiopharmaceutical companies, and Alison DeAngelis wrote a nice piece about that in Stat. Eric, what do you think about this deal and the radiopharmaceutical landscape more generally? Eric, can you hear me?
Sorry about that. Had my mic off. I guess, you know, in terms of Deciphera and Mariana, wow, no surprise, right? Two more oncology deals. Oncology has by far been the number one place for M&A, the number one therapeutic category. And the types of deals that we've seen historically in oncology have been either targeted oncology, much like Deciphera, or radiopharm, much like Mariana. So I guess more of the same. Maybe we've talked about this follow the leader or follow the lemming type of trade in pharma, and oncology is very much in focus. On Novartis and Mariana, I mean, I didn't know the backdrop there, Daphne. That's very interesting about RA Capital and their involvement here. The other thing is, on the other side of the ledger, very interesting about Novartis. I think this is the third deal that they've done in radiopharma. They also just this week announced another collaboration in radiopharma as well. So they are all over this space. I guess they must view this as a land grab opportunity. We've done a lot of work here at Cantor and my partner Lee Watzek following all these private companies in the radiopharm space. I think they're now, you know, by our count, at least 15 or 20 very high quality such private names. I guess the question I now have is whether any of these will make it to the public markets, or whether they'll all be snapped up by big pharma even before they can get to an IPO. So definitely a lot of transactions and a focus right now on radiopharm.
Yeah, we also had the Fusion AstraZeneca deal.
Daphne, let me maybe supplement what Eric said too, because Mariana and my colleague Tyler was following closely, and I know them a little bit as well. We're a very, very unique and interesting company. And first of all, really innovative. So a lot of, as we all know, usually when there's a validated target, there's a line of companies kind of working on that. They decided not to do that with radiopharmaceuticals. They were actually going into a validated target, but specifically DLL3. I don't think there's many radiopharmas going in that direction. They're actually going to go into the clinic this year. They have full manufacturing in-house. They have very novel technologies, multiple redundancy on access to radioisotopes. So they're really small, but unbelievably vertically integrated initially. They have a long shelf life for their radiopharmaceutical isotopes, plus a fairly deep pipeline and a really good team. So this was unique. I mean, there's a reason this they did a deal that quickly, and they're going to be in the clinic very quickly. This would have been one of the better IPOs, so still a very good outcome.
Yeah, speaking of Novartis, another Novartis acquisition announced this year was MorphoSys. Adam, you and Stat had an exclusive story this week on how an emerging safety issue in MorphoSys phase 3 cancer study may complicate its acquisition by Novartis. Tell us all about this, and also curious how you got the scoop.
Can I say I'm having the time of my life reporting on this story? It's been fun.
Yeah, and you also flagged the they had a material adverse event clause earlier a few months ago. I'd love to hear all about it.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, the funniest thing about this story is that I hear from all of these European fund managers and asset managers who are just really polite, and they all have great accents, and they all want me to just shut up because I think they all own MorphoSys, and they want the deal to close as fast as possible. So that's always fun. I think what's interesting about this deal, just even stepping back to February, I think, when the deal was announced that, you know, this is a drug, pelabresib, that has had a sort of very mixed history. It was a kind of very contentious company. MorphoSys bought the drug when they bought Constellation. I think it was a drug that there was a big bear bull debate over this drug. And I think that's continued. So I think there was some like puzzlement, like why, you know, what is Novartis see in this drug, you know, particularly given the fact that the phase 3 study had these very mixed results where they didn't hit on symptom score in myelofibrosis, which is really important from a regulatory standpoint these days, it's particularly in the frontline setting when you're combining it with ruxolitinib. So the story that I wrote on Sunday was just this emergence of these cases of AML transformation. Six of these cases in the pelabresib arm of the phase 3 study, two cases in the control arm. The FDA sent a communication to physicians, investigators in the study, asking them to monitor patients. So that kind of just adds this kind of new potential safety wrinkle. Based on my reporting, I don't know if anyone truly understands why these cases are occurring, and they haven't been definitively linked to pelabresib. I know that there's been some preclinical rationale for it, but that has not been clearly defined and hasn't been demonstrated, you know. But it just sort of adds to this whole drama around this thing. Because what's super fascinating to me about this is that, you know, you've got all this stuff going on with the drug at the same time that Novartis is trying to close the deal.
Eric, you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I mean, first, Adam, just amazing work. Congratulations. And you're right. You know, pelabresib has been a very controversial drug candidate for a long time. I mean, honestly, I could probably see it going either way at the FDA, because there are some reasons why you could envision a regulator looking at the data that they have positively. But certainly the AML risk that you uncovered is a new risk. And so, again, congrats on that scoop. To me, I guess one of the things that I noted in your research is that it just sounds like behind the scenes, as you said, you'd love to be a fly on the wall at Novartis. You know, there's almost a lack of alignment, it seems, with regard to why this deal is happening. And I'm curious as to, you know, what you do think is going on behind the scenes at Novartis, because it is a strange time to be acquiring this company ahead of what's a binary.
I mean, what I have heard, you know, and again, I reported this back, I guess, back, you know, or after the deal had been announced, just that there was internal conflict, you know, that this was not a deal, that there was not unanimity within Novartis about whether or not they should buy MorphoSys or not, that there was definitely disagreement. Mostly what I heard was on the regulatory side, that there was a genuine feeling that this drug would not, you know, would have trouble getting FDA approval, but that there were, you know, again, people in management. I'm not going to name who, because I have not confirmed who the big proponents of the deal are. I have a guess, but I'm not going to say just because I haven't confirmed it, but that there were people, you know, who were pushing this deal hard. And there's an interesting overlap on the board too. One board member overlap, and the deal happened. That's what I know about it. And now that this happened, I think the other thing we should mention, you know, and Eric, you mentioned, you know, sort of pros and cons of whether or not this could get through the FDA. I think, you know, also last Friday, you know, we heard from AbbVie with their BTK inhibitor that they were developing for myelofibrosis, that, you know, they said, I think publicly, well, really kind of publicly for the first time, where, you know, AbbVie pointed out that, you know, they were not going to file in myelofibrosis in the front line in combination with Rux. And specifically they cited the totality of the data and also recent communications that they had with regulators. And I thought that was a very interesting comment from AbbVie, because that drug and Pella, you know, there's a lot of similarities there. And so I thought that what AbbVie said Friday was very interesting.
And at this stage, Adam, do you think it's too late and the deal goes through, or do you have a view on that?
You know, that's where I get a million opinions, and it usually falls along the lines of what stock you own. Yeah, I mean, there's people told me that, you know, when they looked really deep into these contracts and these agreements, that Novartis is committed and that there's really no way for them to back out. And then I've had other people tell me that, you know, they there is this possibility. Now, I know that Novartis had been buying the stock in the open market. And then someone even this week told me that maybe they had seemed like either they were slowing down or they had stopped buying it. I don't have an answer to that question. I wish I did. I'm just not, you know, it seems like, you know, it depends on how you interpret, you know, the all those indecipherable clauses in those purchase agreements. So I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah, I find the internal politics angle to be super interesting. Like, you know, this lack of alignment, maybe some people who weren't happy about the deal potentially leaking. I'm just guessing. That just seems somewhat dysfunctional.
You know, I can't reveal my sources, Daphne. Sorry.
I was trying.
Adam, like you do phenomenal work. I mean, is it? You have a huge network of sources. You do a lot of digging on database on adverse event databases. You know, when you break out good data, like how do you source these stories? Because it's like work. Like it's incredible. It comes out of nowhere, and boof, something huge happens.
I mean, yeah. Again, I don't want to get too deep into sort of how I heard about this. You know, I heard about this. So I mean, just on the timeline, I had heard about this a week ago. Actually, today is when I heard about these cases, and then, you know, kind of quickly understood that this was a pretty significant deal and issue, and kind of worked to confirm them. And you know, there were, and it ended up being, you know, there were a couple of different blood cancer meetings over in Europe last week, where a lot of the experts in the field were gathering. There was one in Germany, and there was one in France, and I mentioned that in my story. And so this, and this issue was being discussed. I don't think these are like really, probably not closely attended meetings by anyone other than, you know, kind of physicians and experts in the field, but these cases were being discussed there. And so that was helpful to me to kind of be able to confirm them. You know, sometimes you're lucky, you know, sometimes you just, you know, somebody reaches out to you, who you trust, and then, you know, you work to confirm it. And I wanted to, you know, the reason that I put it out over the weekend, I usually don't write stories over the weekend, but I wanted to get the story out on Sunday because I knew that MorphoSys was reporting earnings on Monday. And so I wanted to get the story out before then. And also just to be clear, like, you know, over the weekend, I reached out to both Novartis and MorphoSys and, you know, told them everything that I had, right? So like there was no, they didn't wake up, you know, they didn't see that story Sunday and were surprised by anything that was in there. They 100% knew everything that I was reporting because I was trying to get more information out of them. And obviously they didn't say very much to me.
Well, this is a really interesting story and we'll continue to follow it and follow your writing on it. Yaron, you've been tracking earnings, and let's start with Amgen because they provided an interim update on their obesity program, and their value went up by, was it $22 billion? It was pretty interesting. I'd love to have you talk about that and then others comment. I think Adam had some thoughts on how this affects other obesity companies like Vikings. So Yaron, why don't you start?
Yeah, so absolutely. So, you know, there was an element of that was surprising here. And what was surprising is that, you know, Amgen's conducting a fairly sizable phase two, and they did decide to unblind it internally. So it remains blinded to physicians and patients, but it's was unblinded to a select few internally, where they're able to see the data from all cohorts. And presumably, one would imagine they've gotten FDA buy-in ahead of time, because this is a phase two, but it's going to be supportive of the phase three program. And based on that data, and you can imagine they can't say much publicly for a variety of reasons, the most important of which probably is they don't want to unblind, you know, the study for the participants. So what they said is that they were pleased with the dropout rates, and the totality of the data suggests that AMG-133, which, as you know, is a GLP-1 agonist and a GIP antagonist, so it's an antibody with a peptide attached to it, that's dosed monthly, does have a differentiated profile. They wouldn't say a lot, because again, they can't, but they said that it's with respect to the entire field, not just the approved agents. They wouldn't comment on efficacy or safety. The safety, of course, nausea or vomiting. The dropouts were the big issue from the phase one, specifically at one dose to high dose. And recall, the efficacy looked good even at the low doses. And they are doing a dose titration, which wasn't done in the prior study and might have been some of the culprit for some of the dropouts. Although patients, frankly, dropped out at the higher dose, likely not from adverse events. And we can, if there's questions, we can discuss that. And then finally, what was very important is they did say for the first time in granularity that it is an auto-injector. It's handheld. It's a single injection. It's not an on-body device infusion like they're using for Repatha. And so to us, it suggests that they can probably even concentrate the 420 mg high dose using 2 cc's, you know, 2 mL of 210 each. So that's why, you know, a lot of people were kind of negatively biased. I think this came a little bit earlier than expected. I don't think a lot of us expected this kind of granularity. That's not necessarily something usually most companies do, certainly not of this size, but they knew they had to come and just given the interest level. And we think this is the 6 months data out of the 12-month study. And then the 12-month data will be out public sometime probably at the end of this year. So certainly seems like pretty good news, and they're obviously moving to phase 3.
Yaron, can you talk a little bit more about the tolerability? I know that's something that plagued this concept in the past. What exactly did they say?
Yeah, so they you know, as you know, they really can't say a lot. They said that the dropout rates were encouraging. They were not an issue, I think, literally, is the way they characterized it. If we go back to, you know, what they've been saying publicly about the prior data, and they've been alluding to, so recall that the prior phase 1 had a single ascending dose. They ultimately took sort of the mid dose as the high dose in the multiple ascending. If you remember, the single ascending actually is you went to the high doses, had less nausea and vomiting than some of the mid doses. And then when you looked at the multiple ascending doses, the highest dose did have half the patients dropped out, but there wasn't really a dose response below that 100%. And when the patients engine's been saying that they did not drop out because of adverse events. Recall this was a residential study, you know, patients were literally in a clinic. So they knew if they dropped out because of an AE, and they dropped on average 3 to 4 weeks after they got their last dose. It seems like the timing was around the holidays, so there was a lot of extrapolation where the patients wanted to go home. But that's they didn't say much yesterday. I was just kind of recapping what they've been saying leading to that.
Hey, Yaron, I got a question for you, or maybe Eric and Eric, you know, just to, I mean, what strikes me about this is just, you know, we're talking about a company, like we're talking about Amgen here, huge, huge company. And here we are fixated on this mid-stage, you know, asset, and people are trying to interpret these words. And then you're, you know, and then because of that, they added like 20 billion plus, right, to their market cap, which is just like, it's just, when you step back and you think about it, it's just phenomenal what you're seeing here. And I can't recall a kind of another example, maybe like the early days of Alzheimer's, you know, when maybe in the honeymoon period of, you know, of some of the early Alzheimer's stuff, that this was, we saw this kind of reaction to, you know, to early stage data. But for a company of Amgen decided to react this way, it's just remarkable.
Oh, I think you're 100% right, Adam. It seems just like par for the course in obesity these days, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we are talking about markets that are larger than any of us could ever probably have previously contemplated pharmaceutical space. So even though Amgen's a big company, and even though these are early data at best, it's FOMO, right? People are now thinking that potentially Amgen is part of this trade. And for a company that size, it still matters.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just shows you how huge this market potential is and how investors are so focused on it.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, Novo and Lilly both, you know, essentially sort of missed estimates, not by, they're so capacity constrained. Amgen has this new North Carolina plant, you know, up and running now. The Ohio plant that's for manufacturing, and then the North Carolina fill finish plant is going to be ready next year. And they clearly did this interim look to decide whether do we go ahead and invest, you know, God knows how much in manufacturing. The important part here also, maybe that's why it's also so relevant, is, you know, we know there's also a supply shortage of literally the auto injectors. And they went out of their way again to say over and over again that they're dosed monthly or less frequently. And they even said, recall, if you're using the competition, you have to have 4 auto factors. And with us, it's going to be one and perhaps even less than one per month. So, you know, let's see what the data looks like. You know, there's also a fixation for both of you to comment. You know, on Wall Street, we're also fixated on what's the best efficacy. And we're not kind of thinking how many patients actually stay on drug over the long term. And that's going to be an interesting dynamic to follow as well.
How do you guys view this in relation, you know, we're talking about competition. How do you guys look at this in terms of, you know, kind of a long-acting injectable versus an oral? Like, what's the dynamic there? You know, we saw Viking kind of took a hit early. I think maybe the stock has recovered. But what, you know, how do you guys think about that?
Eric, do you want to go? Or you want me to
go ahead? Go ahead, Yaron. Please start.
Yeah. So, you know, on the oral side, a lot of the feedback from our clinicians and Adam, I know you traffic in this very closely, so please chime in. Obviously, you're an expert here. Is one of the issues with the oral, or the challenges, I should say, not the issues, as they are. It is paracrine activity with the gut. These are gut motility. They're essential to gut acting, and when you give an oral drug that goes right into the gut. Sometimes it actually has a narrow therapeutic window potentially, and maybe it doesn't have quite the profound activity that maybe a little bit more of a systemic, maybe potentially longer acting with a slightly better PK, you know, where you can potentially clear that agent and have some recovery will have. So I think our clinicians have been a little skeptical that they will be able to quite match the efficacy. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, the auto injectors once weekly, they're pretty easy. You know, what do you think?
Yeah, I was going to say something similarly, Ron, which is that first to market matters here again. And I think the orals are well behind, not just Lilly and Novo, but now even Amgen. So once you can establish a marketplace with a good injectable, especially a convenient long acting injectable, I think that's going to be hard to displace. Now, obviously, we're talking about potentially millions and millions of patients who could be on these drugs. And Yaron, you already adequately described all the supply constraints that these companies are under. So it may not be a winner-take-all battle. But I do think if the GLP-1s can get to a point where they're formulated into convenient, long-acting, infrequently injectables, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to displace them with just something that's a little bit convenient.
Great. Well, I'm going to go to Luba on a couple of topics, and then we'll come back to other earnings and a couple of data items. So, Luba, you've been tracking some regulatory news stories, including the federal judge throwing out some IRA lawsuits. And also, there was a couple of other things that I think it was FTC going after some junk patents, actually in obesity and other device combos. Actually, maybe that was Eric. So why don't we start with you, Luba, on the IRA lawsuits?
Yeah, sure. So it has been, as we saw, has been proved pretty difficult for pharma companies to challenge IRA. Most recently, we've seen BMS and J&J brought a case in New Jersey federal court against the government, challenging whether it was constitutional for the U.S. government to require drug companies to negotiate with Medicare over their product's price. AstraZeneca brought a similar case in Delaware's federal court as well. And both New Jersey and Delaware courts have dismissed these cases. And the good news is drug makers are appealing. The claim here made by the drug makers is that by requiring to drug makers to negotiate with Medicare, it was essentially an unconstitutional taking of their assets. So in response, one of the judges was very vocal and noted that drug makers have a choice. He didn't buy the argument. They said it's not a taking. They have a choice of whether or not to sell to Medicare. So the government was not taking away their assets. They're not the only ones. As you may recall, pharma also brought a lawsuit in Texas challenging whether IRA price negotiation was legal. That case was also thrown out, but for actually a different reason. Basically, the court said it was not the correct jurisdiction to adjudicate the case. So I would not put all of these cases together as a sign that it will be impossible to get wins here. I think the claims have to be a little more narrow, a bit more focused. Of course, the jurisdiction has to be proper. And as here, it was correctly thrown out because no one was actually based in Texas except for one of the plaintiffs. But that plaintiff had no standing because that plaintiff didn't make any drugs. Although I can see why they chose Texas. It is a preferred type of a court for these types of actions by a plaintiff. But I think the industry is learning here and is going to have to do a little bit more work, be a bit more thoughtful about their legal reasoning and bringing these cases. They're not going to be easy. And also, they will do this. Another reason they may be bringing this right now in this way is that they're recognizing that these are the cases that have to get to the Supreme Court eventually. They may win and redefine the law through the appeals process. And again, they're not the only ones. I mean, we've seen also Novartis and Novo and Merck also brought cases. And again, most likely they will be thrown out and then appeal those cases. So it is only the beginning. But I do think that given limited case law that we have, they may redefine the law here as and adjudicate in the Supreme Court of whether or not this is constitutional.
Yeah, I feel like there's more progress to be made on some of the more incremental approaches of pushing back on, you know, for example, orphan, pushing back on the 9 versus 13. And, you know, I think there's progress being made there. So that seems like that may end up being more productive.
I agree.
Did somebody else want to comment?
Well, I guess I'm just kind of curious, Lou, but I'd say from an investor standpoint, most of us have probably written off any industry attack at this law, yet you seem to think that a more iterative approach is going to meet with some kind of success. I mean, any sense on when we could start seeing that success or what form it might look like? I think, you know, right now at least, track record of suing the federal government doesn't look too good.
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say, again, they recognize that this is something that has to go to eventually will have to go to the Supreme Court and decide it there. Even if one of the courts is going to decide one way, let's say, interpret that this is, in fact, an unconstitutional taking, then and another court, appeals court, decides not, then it's a prime to make case law and bring it to the Supreme Court and adjudicate it there, which would be very interesting. Again, to answer your question, it will take some time. These things take years, but I wouldn't give up on it because we've seen lots of success, even going back to the American Innovation Act is something that was initially hugely potentially detrimental to the pharma industry. This is when basically the act established that anyone could have standing and challenge the patents of Big Pharma. And this was something that was lobbied for by the tech industry, and the pharma industry basically did not track it. And then after the law was passed, realized that it could have detrimental effect. But the pharma industry was very successful both in the courts and also even on the from the Congress and redefine the act and taking more narrow approach similar to what Daphne is saying, go not after whether or not the entire law should be, you know, or the approach is constitutional or not, but actually going after specific issues and working around those issues, such as, for example, having you know, no penalty for small molecules.
Yeah. So my Twitter feed has been blowing up with concerns about avian influenza or H5N1, including alarm bells from people I respect, like Rick Bright, who's the CEO of the Pandemic Prevention Institute at Rockefeller Foundation and previously director of BARDA. Virus has now been found in 36 dairy farms across 9 states. Officially, there's only one case of spillover into humans, but epidemiologists suspect that the true number is higher based on anecdotes from farm workers. And there's been evidence of wild bird to cow, cow to poultry, and one case of cow to human transmission. There's no evidence so far of human to human transmission, but the close contact between cows and farm workers has virologists concerned that it's going to evolve and infect
to infect and spread among humans. There's two vaccines ready that could begin shipping doses within weeks. But, you know, two topics I'll throw over to Luba and Yaron. The first is that all this COVID fatigue, backlash and the partisan nature of COVID, it strikes me that real threats, whether this is the one, but a real threat is, you know, has a risk of being ignored. And then the second question is, you know, if this continues to be a concern, you know, would we see a run up in pandemic stocks like Moderna, BioNTech, Pfizer, et cetera? So I'll throw that over to Luba and Yaron.
Yaron, I don't know if you, go ahead.
Go ahead. You go first.
No, sure. So just really briefly, I have the same, and just in speaking with others, the same fear as you do and others that there is a fatigue right now, COVID fatigue. And not just that, but there's also question as to, and I think this is going to be affecting stocks as well, is question whether or not even if vaccines are becoming available and will become available for this, whether or not it's something that will be taken. So that's that is a big issue, is number one, this potentially being ignored. And then number two is whether or not if there is a vaccine available, if it is something that will be taken.
You know, there's also an interesting thing that I don't know how much press this got, but, you know, apparently when, you know, COVID happened and the U.S. remember funding, when those fundings lapsed, the government didn't honor all the contracts and all the orders that they ordered. So if they, once they ran out of money, they sort of told people, like, we're sorry, I know we took delivery, but we really can't pay you. And thank God, I don't think he got a lot of attention, because I can imagine that would lead to some cold feet and among some companies. But the question is, this viral really, is it really here to stay? I mean, I think Pfizer and Moderna were talking about working on mRNA vaccines, BioNTech's reporting on Monday, and I'm sure they're going to get questions. And then, you know, to your point, Luba, and to your point, Daphne, how extensive is this? You know, I'm kind of, you know, when I go to the store, I'm trying to buy the milk that's the oldest. You know, usually you try to buy the youngest milk. So I'm kind of, you know, each one of us is keeping an eye on this a little bit.
Yeah. And there's, they did find, FDA found something like 20% of the milk samples that they tested had some viral particles, but the pasteurization process apparently kills the virus. That's what they're saying. So, but yeah, you know, raw milk, runny eggs, raw meat. I mean, all of those things, if they're not really tracking, that's the concern, is there hasn't been, you know, they haven't been sort of on it in the way that they probably should be. So yeah, it's better to be safe than sorry, I think. And that's, go ahead.
I can say from staff perspective, you know, this is not my wheelhouse, but I can tell you, like, internally, our public health and science reporters, they are all hands on deck covering this. Helen Branswell, who many of you know is, you know, one of the best public health reporters out there, covered COVID extensively. I think she's written something like 15 stories on this in the last month. So she's like every other day she's writing a story about this. You know, it's you know, again, who knows where this is going? Like you said, Daphne, Luba, and the rest of the guy, like, I also sort of like looking at this like with my hand over my eyes, because like I think we all have, we're like, oh no, not again. And but yeah, it's a huge story, and I know it's something that internally here, you know, we are, you know, we're taking really seriously and it's covering as much as we can.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we're going to hear more about it.
Yeah, and I do wonder, just very quick, in terms of the transmission, I think that it will how it's exactly transmitted and the frequency, I think that's probably what people will be focused on kind of next, right? So if people are really truly tired of COVID and these types of flus and pandemics, I do wonder if people, as you recall, during COVID, people were really focused on the different strains, even of COVID, whether or not, and figuring out whether or not they should be taking a vaccine. depending on the transmission level. I haven't seen much coverage. I'd be curious to read about how quickly this could spread. I wonder if that would be, I don't know the answer to it, but I do wonder if people will be fixed on that to determine if they should be vaccinated or be careful.
For sure. So, Eric, I want to turn back to you. There was a couple of biotech specific news items. The first, BridgeBio spinning out an oncology company and you're basically divesting the cancer assets, raising a bunch of money around it. Love to get your thoughts on that news, and then also on X4. Our colleague Paula Ragan, the CEO of X4, congratulations to her. They got FDA approval of Xolremdi, which is the first drug indicated in patients with WHIMS syndrome. So I'm interested to get your thoughts on those two news stories.
Yeah, thanks, Stephanie. Let's start with BridgeBio then. You're right. They announced just yesterday, I think it was, a $200 million private financing and essentially corporate divestiture or spin out of their oncology subsidiary. They're not really an oncology company. Oncology was probably their third or fourth or even fifth therapeutic category of interest. There's so much going on at BridgeBio in this hub and spoke kind of business model. But they were able to raise money with some very high quality investors. They were able to put together a very formidable management team and board of directors and kick off this new co that they're calling BridgeBio Oncology Therapeutics, or BBOT for short. A nice little business that they've got going here. Three new drug candidates. I think the first is in phase one studies. That's a G12C KRAS on inhibitor. They also have a PI3K alpha that's in preclinical, as well as a G12C multi-inhibitor. But, this KRAS inhibition class has been an interesting area for oncology investors. As many of you know, Mirati and Amgen sort of founded the field with KRAS off inhibitors. And a company called Revolution Medicine has come on strong of late with KRAS on inhibitors. The on inhibitors may end up being more efficacious. There was initially some concern they may not be as well tolerated, but those concerns seem to be fading. And the newest entrant in the KRAS on space is BridgeBio. So I guess what's interesting here.
Oh, Eric, we lost you.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Sorry. I guess what's interesting to me is this company that had been kind of acquiring assets is now spinning them out. And, maybe they're doing that. I guess the speculation might be that the core business could be more attractive without some of the cancer assets, more attractive to acquire, or maybe this cancer business is more attractive to acquire. That seems to be at least what investors are thinking. But Daphne, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these hub and spoke models, they have a lot of advantages in terms of efficiency and the ability to move resources across different programs, and specifically, I think, capital efficiency. But the market doesn't really give credit for all of the value that's sort of trapped within these. So I mean, whether it be BridgeBio or Roivant or even PureTech, there's a lot of different things going on. And, I think what we're seeing and we'll probably see more of is the path to sort of unlocking that value through spinning out some of these assets. And that's definitely something that we did at PureTech. And I think BridgeBio, and I would expect to see similar moves from Roivant, Centessa, and others. So what did you think about the X4? We see these companies get approval and the stock trading down. I don't know if it's short the launch or whatever, but sort of disappointing to see the stock reaction. Curious if you were following the company at all, Eric?
Yeah, no, thank you. And congrats to Paul and her team. This is not a company that I cover, but my colleague Kristen Kluska here covers the story and has been following, I think, very closely. For those of you who are a little bit less familiar with X4, number one, this was, I think, the first and only drug approved this week. So that's a big, big deal, not just for a smaller company like X4, but our industry more broadly. It's always good to get new drugs approved. And Mirixafor is, I think, the generic name of the drug, at least. It got approved for an indication called WHIM syndrome, which is an autoimmune disease. I didn't know this previously, but WHIM syndrome is named as an acronym for the symptoms of the disease, which are warts, hyperglycemia, myelokathexis, which is low red blood cell count, though Yaron can correct me on that if that's not what myelokathexis is. He's the MD on the call. And infections as well. So it's probably a pretty rare disease. We think it's only potentially around 1,000 patients in the U.S. The drug, of course, is priced at a relative premium, as most new drugs for rare diseases are these days. I think, depending on weight, it's somewhere in the $400,000 to $500,000 a year range. So they could make a nice little marketplace out of here. I think, you know, Daphne, your comment on the sell-off, it wasn't severe. I think the stock was down at just a few percent this week. But it does seem like the focus at X4 is on the bigger market opportunity for Rixafor, which is chronic neutropenia. And we're still some time away from that product's launch. So my guess is that, you know, investors saw this coming. I don't think there was a whole lot of debate about whether the drug would be approved or not, and are already kind of, you know, mindful of the bigger game, which is still a number of years away. But I don't know if Yaron or Adam have comments.
I don't know what does this order in, and I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn last night, so I'm going to take a flyer.
Okay, so there was a few other earnings-related updates. We also had Luba wanted to talk about the U.S. government moving to reclassify marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, and then Eric, junk patents and obesity. I don't know. Feel free to jump in on the ones that you guys want to talk about. We have about 9 minutes left.
So I love the junk patent part, but I just on the marijuana very briefly, it's a huge, I know it's not receiving as much publicity, but it's a huge change, just and that it could open up research and medical use in the space. Just as background, there, the DEA is moving to reclassify marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 drug. It has been classified as Schedule 1 since 1970s. And, you know, what are Schedule 1 drugs? These are very dangerous, addictive drugs that do not have any medical uses. And while Schedule 3 drugs, which is if marijuana is reclassified, they can be prescribed. Similar type of Schedule 3 drugs are ketamine, for example, testosterone, steroids, and others that have low dependence, recognized as low dependence. So I think this is could potentially open up even more research and R&D and also medical use in the space. And as we know, many of the states, actually 38 states, have legalized recreational use. But this very strict federal classification prevented medical research in the space. And what's interesting is that if it is reclassified as Schedule 3 drug, that means that all of the dispensaries in the United States, and there are about 15,000 of them, would have to function as regular pharmacies and register with the DEA. So I'm not sure how happy they would be to do that. But you know, I think the opening up of medical use is really exciting. We know that the FDA has approved some cannabinoid-like CBD and THC drugs, for example, for seizures and nausea related to chemo and HIV patients with appetite loss. So we've seen some medical uses there. And just personally, I still remember first when my first year as a litigator, and I was in a federal court and I saw someone get a very, very serious, almost a 15-year in prison for distribution of marijuana, not huge amounts. But again, because it is a Schedule 1 drug, it's, you know, I think this doesn't just change the approaches here in the medical space, but also just how we prosecute these types of crimes. So a very, very interesting and I think a big move by the DEA potentially.
Great. Let's go around in closing and each of you can comment on any other stories that you've been watching. We'll start with Eric.
Well, I feel sheepish introducing this junk patents topic when we have a real lawyer on the phone with real expertise, but I continue to be I guess, somewhat amazed by some of the FTC activity, almost wading outside of its purview into areas like the Orange Book. Just for those of you who don't know, now for the second time in the last 6 months or so, the FTC is challenging, or essentially threatening to challenge, now I think it's 300 Orange Book listed patents, on grounds that the Orange Book should not be accepting patents for drug device combinations. The Orange Book obviously allows for drug patents that are listed to get an automatic 30-month stay and to potentially extend patent lives for these companies. I thought the Orange Book was the FDA's purview. I thought if anyone was unhappy or disappointed with the way companies were using the Orange Book, it ought to be the FDA, not the FTC. But it seems to me like the FTC is methodically going through patent by patent this Orange Book and threatening to change. So maybe Luba, just turn it over to you on what's going on here.
Yeah, no, first of all, you did a fantastic job and laying out what's happening here. They are completely out of their realm. And by the way, we have the Hatch-Waxman. We don't really have much to go. I mean, we should have a separate whole discussion on what that is. There is an actual Hatch-Waxman that has set up a way to ensure competition. And here, again, you're absolutely right, the FTC is playing beyond where it should and could be playing. And by the way, IP, intellectual property rights, is something that is granted by the Constitution. It's just not a proper use of the FTC power. And hopefully, unfortunately, there are a number of backers in Congress to back this. And I hope that there are some legal minds that, and I'm sure they are already working on behalf of Novo and other pharmaceutical companies to actually push on that, because there is tons of legislation that has been set up to adjudicate exactly this if there is a challenge to an Orange Book patent. But it certainly shouldn't be going through FTC in this way.
Great. Yaron, any last thoughts before we wrap up? And then we'll go to Adam.
Maybe just one for me that we're following is SpringWorks reported their first quarter for OGSIVEO. It was approved for desmoid tumors back in late November. They had a very nice Q4, which is really December number, and then a really nice Q1 number, beating consensus. Consensus was $11 million. They put up $21 million. It's the only approved drug, very well tolerated. Women could and patients could be on it for a very long period of time. They're mostly women. And the stock sold off. And it sold off because of a variety of never-ending concerns from Wall Street in oncology. It's either launching drugs too slowly or you're launching them too quickly, and how fast are you going to plateau? And it was sort of hard to get that. What's the right number that makes people happy without leading to a lot of, you know, kind of headwinds and new concerns? And the stock was down. We actually think it's going to do very well in the launch this year, but it's a tricky dynamic. I know we don't have a lot of time, but we could probably, you know, it's something we see over and over again on Wall Street. But we like this drug. We think it's going to do well.
Great.
Can I just say really quickly, just a closing remark, because this is all happening, I would say, in the last couple of months. I mean, we see, and I probably would recommend, and I know the industry is very well aware of this, but, you know, we talk about acquisitions, we talk about patent cliffs for companies, and we talk about the stock market and the biotech stock, and all kind of in a siloed way. But I think it's important for us to recognize that we're getting very strong pressure. We just saw the Biden administration try to get more money and wasn't able to get more money. They were not able to get more money for the cancer moonshot. Just a reminder, the money after 7 years, that about $1.5 billion that was approved for that, that funding ended in 2023, and no additional funding was granted. So we're getting pressure from NIH, so drying up of NIH money for innovation. We're getting pressure on the actual pricing and negotiation. We're getting pressure on the patents. So it's just something to really be aware for our industry, and I think starting to articulate better the value that the industry brings to patients.
Yeah, and that's a big focus for bio. Doing a lot of work trying to to really push forward, you know, what it is that this industry does and differentiate it from pharma more generally. Some of these things that appear concerning on the surface actually could be quite bullish for like smaller and mid-sized biotechs, because it will increase pressure on the larger companies to acquire and fill their pipelines. So some of it is sort of mixed and less negative than you'd think, but the industry's definitely got to do a better job representing itself. So Adam, it was a pleasure to have you on today. I don't know if you have any closing remarks, but you can close out the show for us.
I don't, but thank you, Daphne, for inviting me. And Luba and Yaron, Eric, it was great chatting with y'all. And I'm going to buy a ukulele after this call ends. So maybe next time you have me on, I'll play my ukulele for you.
That would be awesome.
All right. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend, everyone. See you next week on Biotech Hangout.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.